Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 23rd, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is John Marty. Today's session is entitled Chemical Dependency and Mental Health Care. Let's listen in to what Senator Marty has to say.
This is a session on chemical dependency and mental health and public policy and politics related to that. I'm John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota who has worked somewhat in the mental health field and more extensively in chemical dependency issues. And wanted to talk about where we stand in society in addressing these issues, which from the introductory paragraph they said this morning, suggests that we don't do a very good job at addressing these issues, not because we don't know that much, but because we're unwilling to carry out what we do know. And every year, especially in both of these fields, we're learning a lot of new things about how to treat them, how to help address the issues, but our knowledge grows a lot faster than our will to act. I'd like to start by telling two stories that I heard about because of interest in the issue of the death penalty. The session's not on the death penalty. One of them was about 8 or 10 years ago, a particularly brutal murder in California. I think it happened in the early to mid-80s, but a guy went out in cold blood, murdered two teenagers at a fast food joint, and after he murdered them, he calmly finished their hamburgers. And it was a terrible story and brutal killing, and through the course of the case, which he was in the early 90s was executed for, in the trial transcripts, you found out something about this kid's history. He was born prematurely to an alcoholic mother who delivered him very quickly after her husband came home drunk one day, accused her of being pregnant with somebody else's child, kicked her into the bathtub, and somehow the trauma of all that, and when she fell backwards into the tub, was enough to cause the delivery. The father was convinced it wasn't his child. He beat the kid regularly. He knew at the time that anything happened, he was supposed to be ready for a beating. Anything anybody did wrong, he was going to be beat. They said that the court transcripts had his brothers and sisters saying anytime he'd reach for some food at the table, his father's fork would hit him in the back of the hand. They said by age 7 or 8, he was torturing little animals. Very sick individual, and we can see where it comes from some. And never along the line, he was learning disabled, he had umpteen problems. Nowhere along the line did he get any help. The transcripts from his school always talked about school teachers and others saying this kid is desperately needing help, but we ignored it and created a monster that later on did some monstrous things, and we executed him, and that ended that case. There's another one right now that's made news, and the way I've heard about it is this is the second time now the U.S. Supreme Court, which is not by any means anti-death penalty, but a second case, this is second time this individual, and I confess I can't recall whether it was Texas or Oklahoma, an individual who did a particularly brutal rape and then murdered and admitted to the police, I told her I was afraid she was going to rat on me or whatever, so I took a knife, and he described very graphically to the police how he murdered her while she's begging for her mercy, for her life. And the U.S. Supreme Court threw it out, saying that Texas, I believe it was, their law required a jury, if they found that it was intentional, that it was premeditated, that they knew it would result in death, that several other things happened, that they must order the death penalty. And the Supreme Court, 6-7 years ago, threw out the case, sent it back to court, saying, you know, you got to take into account that the individual had a mental health problem, mental illness, and had the mental capacity of a 6 or 7 year old. And they went back through the court system again convicted him, and this time the judge gave some sort of cryptic comment about you can take a look at other factors, mitigating factors, but still the instruction still read, if these three things are present, you shall sentence them to death. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the same case, sent it back again and said, no, you're not listening to us. And we've seen many other cases where people who are mentally ill, you know, we have to give them medication to make them sane enough, to heal them enough so that we can kill them. This is not a talk about the death penalty, but I wanted to use those two stories to suggest that a lot of times we see very, very sick people who we fail to address. It's not a priority of ours, and in the end, society pays a terrible price for it. Why don't we talk about it? Well, there's a stigma to the illness. I'm told that 50, 60 years ago, if somebody had cancer, people, maybe for because of people with religious belief, would say, well, this is God's punishment for them, something they had done wrong. There was some sort of stigma to even a lot of physical illness. Now there still is, though maybe it's lessening, to chemical dependency and alcohol and drug abuse and to mental illness, but still it's something we hush up because we're scared to talk about it, we're embarrassed about it. So they remain in many ways hidden problems, though they're both very prevalent in society. Some mental illnesses become more acceptable. Depression, because so many of us have experienced it. Those things seem to be more acceptable, though more serious mental illnesses we still don't understand and we don't want to understand. And part of the way we've dealt with this in the past, at least with the mental health situations, has been institutionalization. We lock people up who are different than us. We used to lock people up because they were disabled, because they had mental illness, things we couldn't understand. The situation until, in some states, the 60s, locking people up who should have their freedom, but because of an illness, we locked them in a cell, basically, was inexcusable. And so you can say that what happened in the early, in the late 80s and the 90s, where we deinstitutionalized, not the late 80s, earlier than that, where we deinstitutionalized people, it was a great move. But we didn't do anything to replace it. We removed people who had serious and persistent mental illness. We took them out of these state institutions where they didn't belong, and instead of giving them alternative care, either in group homes and making sure somebody's tracking them, making sure they get medication they need, other things, we didn't use the knowledge we knew. We just, that's too expensive. It may have been cheaper than the institutions, but we saved money by kicking them out of the institutions and throwing them out onto the street. So we've ignored those alternative services that we could do. And as I said earlier, I think we know a lot more about both mental illness and chemical dependency than we knew 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, but we failed to follow through with our knowledge. What I like to suggest we could do about both of these things, if we have the political will, is to, in many cases, prevent the problems from occurring or from getting worse, and in other cases, to give treatment to those situations, and we'd all be better off in doing so. I think we all know that untreated mental illness and chemical dependency, not in most cases, fortunately, does not cause murder. There are very, very mentally ill people who are of no risk to anybody outside of themselves and maybe not even to themselves, other than it does destroy their life and the life of their family and makes it extremely difficult. It also robs society at large, the community, their employers, of what would be a productive citizen employee. It takes that all away and destroys their life and their family's life, and many others of us are affected as well. So my premise is that the ounce of prevention that's worth a pound of cure is something we ought to be looking at in both of these areas. And in doing so, in trying to suggest that an ounce of prevention is cheaper than that pound of cure, I often talk about the fact that it saves both healthcare dollars and crime costs. But in doing so, I want to be cautious about not trying to make the stigma worse, because again, most people who are chemically dependent don't break laws other than when it's illegal drugs, they're breaking laws on the consumption of those illegal drugs. But most people with mental illness and most people who are chemically dependent are not out there committing brutal acts. Those are not, they are contributing factors perhaps to crime, but there are many people, we shouldn't tie them too close together and make the stigma worse. But they do, in many cases, contribute to crime and violence. In Minnesota and nationwide, I believe, the leading cause, crime, criminal cause of death is drunk driving. Minnesota, I think a typical year we have 100 to 150 murders of all kinds, every kind put together, and we'll have 200 drunk driving fatalities. And at least in the past, we've been ahead of most of the rest of the country in addressing that issue. And so I will assume most other states have, if it's not the leading cause of murder or death is a crime, it's one of the leading ones. And in, I also know that of those murders we have in Minnesota, last year I think there were 46 domestic murders where a spouse or former spouse or housemate or somebody goes out and kills their partner and their children. 46 murders in Minnesota last year. I'm told by people who study those situations that probably 9 out of 10 or more occur while the person who commits the murder is under the influence of usually alcohol, sometimes other drugs. And you hear the stories of people who have been abuse victims say, when dad came home drunk, it was murder. It may have been not the best parent in the world, but when he had been drinking, it was much worse. And therefore, maybe one of the reasons I suggest it's an ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure is that we reduce crime and healthcare costs. And this isn't just a perception of what happens. We have a lot of documentation of that. California, 4 different counties about 10 years ago did a pilot project dealing with troubled youth, and they took only the most serious offenders, the ones who committed what we call felony level crimes if they were adults. They took in these 4 counties, they made an aggressive effort for a few years to make sure that every kid who was in the system with a serious crime like that would get screened, assessed for whether they have chemical dependency or mental health problems. And if they had problems, they'd make sure they got some treatment, some help. And not, perhaps not surprisingly, while there are many who have these problems who don't commit crimes, a very high percentage of kids who are committing crimes have one or both or multiple alcohol, drug, or mental health problems. Those death penalty cases I mentioned earlier, you can tell when you hear the court transcript, the one in the Texas case where the guy was the behavior of the mental capacity of a 6 or 7 year old. That individual in the court transcripts and again when they had the recent Supreme Court ruling overturning the death sentence, they interviewed a neighbor who said, yeah, when he was a little boy, he'd be screaming at the top of his lungs for hours about his mother beating him and everything else, and nobody intervened. And they interviewed this neighbor saying there were so many times she called the police, nobody did anything, and the kid was just left that way. You know, this California pilot project found out that by aggressively treating this, and I don't know California's system as well as I know our own states, but I would care to bet that even when they made an aggressive pilot project like this, the level of treatment and care they provided probably wasn't as great as you'd like to see, but they still had a 50% reduction in recidivism, in repeat offenses from these kids. 50% reduction. And we talk about how, you know, if we could cut crime by 5-10%, it'd be a great thing. And in recent years, because of demographics and some other things, we've had a national drop in violent crime. But it's been a few percentage point drop, and the main good news is it's not continuing to go up. But here are these 4 counties had this pilot program that had a 50% reduction in repeat offenders. And these are the kids who later on tend to do more serious things later. They were expanding their thing to include more minor offenses. Again, the earlier intervention is always better. you have a better chance if you catch kids before they do too serious of things. But they found out that it cut it in half. In chemical dependency theory, I've worked in more than California, maybe because it's a bigger state, has had the money to do more studies, more research, more everything else. And these studies have been replicated in many other places as well. But in the early 1990s, under the radical governor, Pete Wilson, who was not by any means some big government interventionist, he probably was not the strongest supporter of chemical dependency treatment and government investments in this. But his administration called for a study that had been done. They said it was the most intense study of chemical dependency treatment and its effects in the country to that time. And in that study, they found out from 1991 to 94 that for every dollar the taxpayers put into treatment and prevention of drug and alcohol abuse, most of its treatment and very expensive to provide treatment, every dollar taxpayers put into that, they saved $7 in healthcare and crime costs alone. It's not a 17% rate of return, which might be pretty nice. It's not 70%, it's a 700% rate of return. In 3 years, it paid back that much by reducing crime and healthcare costs. It's the kind of thing that, you know, most private investors would say, let's do more of it. Let's invest everything we can into it. Well, that's what you'd hope would happen, but it's now 10 years later, then that study starts, and we've seen more studies like that. Joe Califano, who used to be the Secretary of Health, Education, Welfare, whatever it was called at the time, under the Carter administration, now heads a Center for Addiction Studies, Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. And they came out with a report this January called Shoveling Up. It was talking about how states are paying the cleanup costs. Again, this was chemical dependency. How they are paying the cleanup costs, and their study estimated that the average state's spending about 11 to 13% of their annual budgets on chemical dependency. Keep thinking, where are these dollars? I didn't know we had that much stuff in chemical dependency. Well, 94% of that 13% of the state budget, which in Minnesota is several billion dollars a year, 94% of that wasn't in chemical dependency treatment or prevention. 94% was the shoveling up, the cleanup cost for failing to treat it through special education costs, through criminal justice costs, the courts and the prisons and law enforcement, and healthcare costs. They documented very detailed documentation in each state how much they did. So 94% was being the cleanup cost. The other 6% went into everything else, the prevention side of the equation. And we see these studies year after year, and not much happens. We don't do it. We've got the people who we released from our state institutions 20 years ago or so now, and what we do is a patchwork system of some of them can get help either through group homes, through nonprofit agencies, through state-funded services, but most don't, or they get inadequate level of care. And chemical dependency, the same sort of thing. And we're finding out not just these government studies, but we're finding other private studies that show the same sorts of things. Bell South, the Baby Bell system in Atlanta, did a study 2 or 3 years ago now on mental health coverage. And it's expensive to provide mental health coverage, to provide comprehensive. Most of them, you know, once the time you need institutionalization, they pick up some of the tab, their plans cover that, though at that time it tends to be person so dysfunctional, they don't have any health insurance anymore, and the taxpayers pick up the cost. But Bell South decided they were going to provide, whether it was negotiated with their employees or just they decided we ought to try this, they provided comprehensive mental health services, and they wrote a report upon it because they found it was cheaper. They had more productive employees if you provide mental health services. If you provide, as soon as they have the first signs of depression or some other mental health problem, you get them the help they need, it does wonders in saving money. So there are others who make progress. There's some private businesses that do this, though at the rate businesses learn from each other, sometimes on this type of thing, it may be 20 years before they decide we ought to do this. And again, since not everybody has employers who provide benefits, period, if we wait for the system to learn about it itself, it's going to take another generation or two before we do something. In terms of one, I wanted to go into in a minute or two and then open it up for the discussion, but before that, I wanted to talk about a bill that I've introduced to try and address the mental health side of it, but I wanted to talk relatedly to the mental health commitment issues. Because at the time, it took advocacy for mentally ill people from got a pesky flyer on it. We've got the advocacy groups for people who are mentally ill decided they were going to, excuse me, the one fly in the room seemed to have decided I'm worth hovering around. The people who got the mentally ill individuals out of these state prisons, in effect, the state institutions, the ones who got them out of there were advocates for the people, trying to make sure they were treated more humanely, that they got the health care they deserved and could live lives of independence in the community. They fought hard to get this, and I think they did a wonderful job. But we now have many cases where we have people who we know are going to do their danger to themselves or to someone else. And in Minnesota, at least, we're having a fight now on trying to get involuntary commitment laws strengthened a little bit so that people, when you know, because mental illness is unlike other illnesses, you don't know about your illness until you're in treatment. With other types of things, the doctor tells you, you've got cancer, you need this and this and this. Yes, I've got cancer, I need this and that treatment. With mental health issues, somebody tells you, you have it. Until you're in treatment, you're not able to address your ability to need treatment. And a lot of parents, they have a constituent whose son shot at a police officer in Texas. He was convinced God was the devil or somebody was in the police officer fighting him, and so he shot at the police officer, injured him. I think it was more like a pellet gun or a BB gun or something than a deadly firearm, but anyhow, he got a life sentence in Texas. They were transferred him up to Minnesota. And the parents, who are very active in mental health things, he's a schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic individual. And even our Minnesota's, quote, enlightened correctional system didn't do anything about it. Matter of fact, they were threatening to send him down to Texas because the governor, the former governor, was getting letters from this guy. And as a legislator who served on crime committees, we sometimes get lots of letters from inmates in prison saying how they're being mistreated and how the court system cheated them and the prison system is torturing them and all sorts of other things. Anyhow, the governor was tired of getting letters from this guy, and somehow the courts told him, the correctional system told him, you stop writing these letters, we're going to send you to Texas. But this guy was mentally ill, and he incapable of stopping doing this without some help. The parents finally persuaded the system to let them bring in an outside psychiatrist to take a look at their son. He prescribed some medication, two or three medications, they got it going, and the son is now graduating from a college course in prison, doing very well. He needed help, and the parents are saying, look, you know, we would have prevented this unfortunate incident in Texas from ever happening. All this would happen. They were trying to get their son into treatment, but they couldn't force him to, even though he was a threat, clear threat to himself and to others. Delusional, serious situation. And so they're trying to, in Minnesota now, try and make it so it's a little bit easier to get the temporary hold where you can get somebody in and get them in for some medication and see if they need the help, see if they can be helped, instead of waiting till it happens, because under Minnesota court cases, it's sort of been until you can show imminent danger, which the courts have interpreted to be like, if you walk out the door right now, you're gonna go hurt somebody. Imminent, in the court's interpretation, is not meant if you're likely to kill or injure yourself or somebody else in the next 2 or 3 weeks. That's not imminent. And parents and family members are saying, you know, we gotta change it. Unfortunately, it's been a very divisive issue because a lot of the advocates who fought so hard to get people out of the institutions are now afraid, are we going to go back to the old thing? I don't think we're going to. I don't think we should. But I do think we have to address that commitment issue. Now, the one thing I mentioned a minute ago I'd like to get into before opening it up, how do we address this? The biggest single obstacle to addressing this wisely is providing the funding that we need to address it. And Minnesota, like many other states, has had a budget surplus, and while we seem to be incapable of using that to address some basic needs, we certainly could. You can argue we could use it to do chemical dependency treatment. I concluded we're never going to unless we set aside a separate system of funding for it. So I proposed, why shouldn't the people who profit from the sale and those who consume the substance that causes most of our substance abuse in this country, most of the substance abuse that causes harm to other people, the chemical dependency outside of cigarettes, why shouldn't the people who profit from its sale and who consume it, why shouldn't they pay the cost of cleaning up their mess? Since the Columbia University study says taxpayers are shoveling up the cost, why shouldn't the industry and the users of it pay for it? So I propose, it's not a new idea, California had an initiative for a penny a drink alcohol tax. And a former public safety commissioner in Minnesota 30 years ago suggested a nickel a drink. I figured even without adjusting it for inflation, a nickel a drink would do a lot of good. And so I proposed a bill, and the first half of the bill, anybody, anything to do with chemical dependency, says is really great. And the second half of the bill, paying for it, all of a sudden people, they back off. Not the people who recognize the need for it, but the political world does. What did the bill do? It was going to, I suggest it would be far and away the most aggressive attempt to address chemical dependency anywhere in the country. And it's not a partisan issue. Our Senator Paul Wellstone, who's a Democrat, and a congressman from Western Minneapolis area, Republican, have both been active on both chemical dependency and mental health issues. And this Republican congressman wrote a column in our local paper a year ago talking about what if we took the billion, 2 billion, whatever we're putting into buying helicopters for drug interdiction in Colombia, spent those billions here at home to treat, in other words, reduce the demand rather than the supply, which we've done so poor at doing. Why don't we reduce the demand for drugs? Why don't we reduce the demand with chemical dependency treatment? He's particularly aware of it. He's been very upfront about the fact that he has had himself, he's a recovering alcoholic. He's not ashamed of it. He talks about it openly and very good at educating people. And his point is exactly right. Let's invest the money up front and do it. It makes it a smart way to go. So I had a hearing, and William Cope Moyers, the son of Bill Moyers, who's been also very open about his addictions, he was near dead, I think, from several heavy drug addictions, and went through treatment 3 times. He has family resources to help cover the cost of treatment. It took him 3 times, but he finally, after having lost his career and his marriage and everything else, he got his act together and got good treatment and succeeded. And he now works full-time in the field of this. And so we had him come testify to what it does to somebody's life and how all of a sudden, by getting treatment, he's a tax-paying, productive citizen and has a family and doing well and participating well in the community, and why can't others get the same thing? We were going to provide, and I'm trying, I wasn't calling it a chemical dependency bill, I was calling it a crime and DWI prevention bill, saying that we could cut DWI fatalities by at least a third, far more than anything else we can do. And I've carried bills on lots of ways to reduce it, but this would cut it more than anything else we do. And those domestic violence murders, we might cut it from 46 in women, 40 women and 6 kids last year down to maybe a third of that if we'd aggressively treat this. I think we'd cut violent crime by more than a quarter if we would invest in this. So what did I propose doing? I had the whole range of things, including the funding to provide for correctional costs. Minnesota is just making DWI a felony for the first time this year. It's extremely expensive. I don't object to doing it. It's a serious enough crime, but it's not the first place I'd put the dollars. But putting funding in for those things, for more law enforcement officers, because 2 in the morning, a lot of counties, you have no chance of getting caught drunk because there's no law enforcement on the roads, period, because they're sparsely populated counties, they can't afford it. But put some more efforts into the corrections and the catching of people and all of those sorts of things. But the main gist of what I was going to do was to make sure that we were going to require 2 things. One was to require anybody who had committed any kind of crime, any DWI or any crime of violence, to get immediately assessed for chemical dependency problems. And if they were assessed that they had a problem, what level of treatment did they need? Not have the insurance company or somebody else determine what they think is appropriate, but have the neutral assessor determine what's the appropriate level of care, and then make sure they get the care. We weren't going to make it a heavier burden on insurance. We weren't going to let them off the hook any more than they are already, because they're backing away from it in the past, and they seem to continue to. They find out it's pretty costly. And with, unlike some other illnesses, if a health plan ignores chemical dependency, they don't have to worry about it long term, because usually that individual becomes so dysfunctional they lose their job and their health care coverage, and then the state becomes responsible anyhow. But not let the insurance industry off the hook. But if somebody doesn't have insurance coverage, and if they don't have the personal ability to pay for that level of treatment, the state would, on a sliding fee scale, make sure they get it. No Minnesotan would be turned away from appropriate level of treatment and aftercare that they need because of lack of funds. It's costly, but it's pretty important to do. We're going to make sure everyone did. And then when I started talking with some judges about this, they said, well, why are you doing it just for violent crimes and things like DWI? What about family court, where kids are in their what we call CHIPS cases, children in need of protection because of abuse or neglect? Heavy, heavy percentage of those cases, very heavy percentage, are caused by alcohol, drug abuse. Why don't you require in those cases, courts can't force the person to do it, but they can force it as a condition of having access to their children. The court does have a lot of clout to force people into it. They wanted to make sure in family law cases and those child abuse neglect cases that they also get screened and assessed right away, and make sure as a condition of it, the judges can then say, if you're going to get your kids back, you have to go through this program. If you don't have the funding, here's the funding stream to help pay for it. And not only would you be doing this on a for the treatment at the level you required, but in many cases, you know, you go through somebody who's take a very serious addiction, and they may need 3 months inpatient care. But right now, even the health insurance plans, and even when government or someone else does get somebody the care they need, next thing they do, they throw them out on the street. They go back, they're still homeless, they're still unemployed, they're still whatever else. They go back in the same setting where the people they were living with are abusing. You need the halfway houses. You need the aftercare. You need to hook them up with an AA type of program, some sort of ongoing support group type of thing. You need to help people after they're done with treatment. And, you know, this is all pretty expensive, but this nickel a drink that I proposed to pay for it was raised in Minnesota $110 to $120 million a year, which was more than enough to cover all these costs. And while the liquor industry, we passed it out of one committee, though, only with them taking out what was the appropriate level of the tax increase, they left blank amount per drink on what the cost increase would be, because they didn't want to say they voted. They didn't want their opponents to say, you voted for a nickel a drink increase in taxes. Politically, it should be saleable. There were 2 different studies in Minnesota. University of Minnesota poll in 1995, 85% of Minnesotans would support an increase in alcohol taxes to fund initiatives aimed at reducing DWI and other crimes related to the excessive consumption of alcohol. 85%. Politics, 65% is a landslide. 1998 poll for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation found 80% of Minnesotans support increasing, again, these are increasing alcohol taxes to pay for programs to prevent minors from drinking and to increase alcohol treatment programs. So you got overwhelming landslide support for this, but I believe California 10, 12 years ago had a voter initiative for a penny a drink on alcohol to do it. and I believe it was defeated. I was told Anheuser-Busch, brewers of Budweiser and other beverages, spent $17 million to defeat it. Always talking about how it costs and why do we need new taxes. And some of my colleagues, one of my colleagues who said, oh, he really wanted to help out. He wanted to help me because he thought it was a good bill. But he was his way of helping the bill was to take the taxes out. But John, you know, we got a surplus. I told him, there's no way in the world we're going to do this without the funding for it. So basically, while the funding is maybe the thing, the tax increase may be the thing that kills it, taking out the tax kills it just as effectively. And how do you get around that? I'm convinced, and there is a new national group being formed and a Minnesota group being formed to try and pull together the recovering community, people who are themselves chemically dependent and recovering, people who work in the field and aware of the things, family members, others. There are a lot. There are tens of thousands of Minnesotans who could be involved in this, and despite the stigma, many of them will be involved if they have a chance to make a difference. So I'm convinced we can build that public support. The liquor industry comes in and says, oh, you're going to tax us to death. And one guy from southern Minnesota, 20 miles from the Iowa border, saying how, you know, if we have to charge a nickel a drink more for stuff, it's going to shut down our bar or restaurant business. And I was thinking, you know, just using the math in my head, if my wife and I went out, if we lived in that town, went out to his bar and had six drinks apiece, which I'll guarantee you neither of us would do. I don't think I could handle six drinks. But if each of us would drink six drinks apiece, that's 30 cents apiece more, 60 cents more. If you pay for current government reimbursement or government tax deduction for mileage is, I think, 34 cents a mile now. You couldn't get 2 miles closer to the Iowa border before you run out of money. That's for six drinks a person for a couple, let alone getting back. So people, but oh yeah, it's still going to cause people to cross the border to do it. And there, I don't want to suggest there's no truth to that, because some people will drive 20 miles to save a few bucks, even if without factoring in the fact that they're spending a lot more to do it. But the idea that he said, oh, everybody in the Twin Cities area was going to race to Wisconsin, 30, 40 miles away, and some size, east side of the metro area, 15 miles away, that they're going to race off to Wisconsin to save a nickel a drink, is naive and foolish, and it's scare tactics in order to defeat it. But they've been very successful in doing that. And again, I'm convinced, and before I open this up, I'm convinced that the only thing that stops us from addressing these things is the lack of political will, because it costs money, and even if it saves $7 for every dollar we invest, we're not willing to invest it because it costs money. With that, I'd like to open it up for discussion or additions or challenges or whatever.
What about education?
Education in terms of
early, yes.
Education is both, I don't know that education about mental illness would prevent it, but it would certainly help us recognize it. With chemical dependency, it certainly can have an impact. There's a lot of discussion whether the DARE program for drug stuff is very effective or not. And I happen to think it all depends how you do these things and how much impact you expect them to have. You teach fifth, sixth graders about the importance of staying away from alcohol and drugs, and everything they see in every movie and everything else is the sophisticated people, the sophisticated adults, the cool people are the ones doing it. I mean, it's the same thing with tobacco addiction. The industry aims, especially with tobacco, they have to aim at kids because adults don't start smoking, but with drinking, very heavy percentage of people who abuse alcohol, the earlier you start, the studies have suggested, the more likely you are to abuse later on. And it's illegal for kids to do it, and yet you look at messages they get in the news media, in the advertising world, it's the people they should want to be like are the people who consume alcohol. And some of the advertising, while they'll insist it's not aimed at minors, certainly is appealing to minors. I remember I clipped it a couple years ago. Philip Morris sent us as legislators, or R.J. Reynolds, one of the two of the tobacco companies, sent us a booklet, a high four-color glossy booklets showing what they were doing to prevent youth consumption. In one page, they have a message to youth. It says, hey, kids, you know, cigarette smoking is something you shouldn't be doing. This and certain other things, these are things that you should use your judgment, wait till you're an adult to do and so on. Things like drinking and smoking and sexual activity and so on. Those are grown-up things. I mean, this is basically the message you get from it. These are grown-up things to do. So, and you're just a little kid, so you stay away from this. But tell me what kid doesn't think, hey, I want to be... It's exactly the rest of their message. You want to be sophisticated. You want to be a beautiful person. You do this. I think education can have a major impact on reducing early intervention, early prevention through education, through even young kids and so on. But we have to recognize that, you know, a classroom program in sixth grade for a few hours a week, for a few weeks of the year, isn't going to combat what they see every single night on television and on every billboard in the sports stadiums and everything else about Bud.
I'm thinking kindergarten, first grade, there's more and more children experience it at home. You know, bad. The other thing I was going to ask is, what do you think about legalizing?
About legalizing illicit drugs? First, back to your other one, your point, I didn't catch it exactly earlier, but I think you're right, and it's a good point that the kids, I think we do tell kids in kindergarten, first grade, and so on, don't use alcohol, don't use drugs. But your point is when they're experiencing it at home, that could be extremely valuable in terms of helping get their parents and others into treatment or getting at least other adults to recognize if you see this, if you see your parents doing this, not just you shouldn't do it, but here's what alcohol and drugs do. It's a good point.
Young children, let them know that this isn't right. And
yeah.
And
that they can maybe get help. I mean, like, because a lot of chemical dependency stuff requires outside intervention. If the kids, maybe there's nobody looking at it. I think that's a great idea to try and find a way to get, not just teach kids, which I thought you were getting at, just you kid don't use this, but you know, if you're seeing problems with this, maybe here's how you can get help, because clearly a lot of kids are in homes where there is abuse. That's a good point. Your second half of that was on the legalizing. I've been one who, first of all, I tend not to be a prohibitionist about things. I would not encourage legalization of illicit drugs now. I think it would send kind of a confused, mixed message. I'm not one, I think we should be not being harsher with our penalties. We should be soften some of the penalties for hard drugs. Because drug dependence, I mean, we should try and prevent people from getting on it. But once you're on a drug, it's addictive. I mean, that's the nature of why you can't stop using it. And locking people up because of that is usually not the most productive way to address it. So I'm not a fan of legalization, but what was called decriminalization in the past. I think we should spend a lot more of our resources in that way rather than...
I have a son that's a hopeless. He's 43, and when he was quite young, he was injured. Mm-hmm. And he still hurts, and he still takes drugs. He cannot get drugs from physicians. The minute they find out he's a drug addict, they give him over-the-counter stuff, and mm-hmm. doesn't help him. He went on the legalized thing in Oregon. I don't want to take the whole session because I...
Oh, you mean the legalized for painkiller types of things?
No, he went on legalized drugs in Oregon. They have the methadone.
Okay.
Every morning they go
right.
for it. It costs a small fortune. But it's operated, it's approved by the state, but it evidently is operated by individuals who make a profit from it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I could go into that. But when he was quite young, he got into trouble because of the drugs. And he went to prison and for 6 months. And I talked to the warden, and I said, well, at least he'll get off the drugs. And the warden said, no. In prison, they can get drugs easier than they can on the street. So tell me how you can control drugs if you can't control drugs, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And I could write a book about
right.
our experience. And I have another son that committed suicide. And if it's an addiction in a family, these little children, and I see more and more of them,
mm-hmm.
they go to school, and before they go to school, they know all about these drugs. And
in the school, the education has strictly been don't you use it? And when they're surrounded by people who are, it doesn't, you're, that's a very helpful point. I appreciate hearing that. Because there are, there may be ways we can help use that to help bring people into the system.
It's just gotten so, such a big, and I've been exposed to a lot of it lately because my son has moved home. And I know, there's just, I know a little three-year-old boy who waits until his mother and dad go to sleep. And I'm sure he chews on cigarettes and has alcohol and drugs and, you know, you can't control those things, but you can put it in their minds when they're really young. So I think education.
And maybe the kids themselves can get some of the help that may help them address it. I was going to say, in Minnesota prisons, I'm fairly confident that there's not a lot, I mean, the experience your son had in the prison system there, that there's not that kind of level of abuse in our prisons. And there are actually treatment programs, though again, it's not easy to get into them, and they're too easy to get people out of them because they don't have the room for everybody. And what you would hope happens, at least while we got somebody locked up, is that we are giving them an aggressive treatment program. But we do a very poor job everywhere on that.
But use your reasoning. If you've got a lot of drug addicts, they're desperate people. You can't put them together in a prison without controlling it. And the way you control it is to allow drugs to come in to help them with their addiction. So it's a catch-21 thing.
Well, I think there are some, in various states, there are some very good drug treatment programs in prisons. I think in many cases it doesn't reach everybody and so on. But in terms of the pain relief for people who are injured, I mean, I happen to have been an author of a bill for medical marijuana. And it's interesting, I got one constituent who agrees with me on a lot of things, but she works in with educating of young people on drug stuff with the DARE type program type of thing. And she keeps writing me these letters saying, oh, this is terrible, you're saying mixed messages. And I was gonna say, every 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year old I talk to, I can tell them pretty clearly, they can understand the distinction between saying somebody who's ill, when you go to the doctor, you get a prescription for a painkiller that's not legal otherwise. That giving people comfort in that, I have no trouble explaining and having kids understand the difference between legalizing use of a substance for treating pain and nausea and illness, even if we don't quite understand why it works or how it works, and even if you could get the tablets that have the same active ingredient that don't seem to work for people who take it. I don't see that as a mixed message at all, saying that there are a role for drugs for medical purposes in our society, even if we don't quite understand why it works. And saying that we should be discouraging drug use, because I think we've got real problems with drug consumption in the country. And I think the average 8, 9, 10-year-old kid is able to understand the distinction between, quote, recreational use of a substance and use of a substance for medical purposes, though it could be abused. I agree.
What about Ritalin?
Ritalin. Is it good, bad, or is it being overused or not used at all? Is it a scam? Is it what? Is that the question?
That seems to be a wide open question of whether this is the beginning of drug abuse, convincing kids that they can take care of certain problems by taking drugs, getting drugs in school from the teacher.
The whole issue of Ritalin, I was going to say, your last comment there about how getting drugs from the teacher is interesting, because I know even in our high schools, I think, Elks, are you allowed to, you're not allowed to take most medications, you have to bring them in, give them to the nurse or at high school?
Yeah, if they catch you with like ibuprofen or anything, you get suspended.
Yeah. Teenage girls can't have ibuprofen without. We're sending kind of strange messages here. People who are taking even non-prescriptions at whatever, they're not allowed to have them in schools, which I'm not sure that that's a really healthy message. But with Ritalin, and having studied the issue fairly clearly, I'm convinced that one, it can serve a useful purpose in many cases. And number two, sometimes schools and other places may they've got a child who's got some problems, causing some problems in the school, and maybe medication will be the solution. And I'm not a believer that medication solves all our problems. I think medication can be used appropriately. And I think Ritalin has some very useful purposes with some people, but is it become a fad where they decide we're going to overuse it? I think that can very much be the case. I think your final point there, again, about the teacher dispensing drugs to the kid, that can send a real confused message at times. But again, there are kids who the medication works, and it helps them, and helps them perform better.
I'd like to clarify that, at least in the state of Michigan, the teacher does not dispense that drug.
Yeah.
It comes from the child has to bring it from the home, and it goes to the office, and the child is dismissed from the classroom at a given time of day when they receive that medication, and they go to the office and take it in there. The teacher does not dispense the drug, nor does the teacher advocate the drug. As a former teacher,
my grandson gets Ritalin from the teacher.
Not in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's that trying to keep it, I think one of the reasons it may be given by teachers in some areas is not enough school nurses, and a lot of schools don't have that. I mean, there is a little bit confused message there in terms of it. I think the thing we should do, though, is try and distinguish what's an appropriate use of medication and what's abuse. And I think everything on ADD and ADHD and other things like that talks about how, and I think we should see this about drug abuse as well, and that is that it's not an excuse for, not the drug, but the problem is not an excuse for misbehavior. It can be a cause of it that needs to be treated, but that doesn't excuse you from trying to do hard and trying to work. But you can have two people. I have a friend who has twin kids who both very smart. One was dropping out of college, the other was a straight A student. And one was clearly ADD, he got the medication and got back into college and did fine. And was the kid lazy? Was he whatever? No, it was a clear problem with ADD. And 30 years ago, the kid would have been a dropout. Now he's graduating with help from that, but again, it's been overused in some cases too. And somebody who doesn't want to take the time to go through each student appropriately, this is a troubled kid, let's give him the drug, which is drug abuse as well. Up here, Paul.
Not long ago, I heard a brilliant paper by a very conservative, politically conservative community leader arguing for the legalization of drugs. And he had all kinds of data and so on, but his contention was, one, what we're doing, it doesn't work, and two, money behind illegal drugs is the reason that they're so prolific. So my question to you is then, even if one, and you've already said where you stand, even if one were for the legalization of drugs, would that be political suicide?
Would it be political suicide? I don't think so. George Soros, the billionaire, is devoting a lot of his resources to promoting legalization. I think Barry Goldwater, in many ways, became an advocate of legalization of a lot of substances. It's not a liberal conservative type of divide. And I think the point they make that's very good is the one you're saying. The economic system is driving the drug trade because a kid who can make minimum wage in a job in a lot of cities can make 30 times that, 50 times that by just helping with the distribution of illicit drugs. You can make a lot more money. How you tell a kid, maybe you get a couple bucks an hour more for doing something illegal, they might not do it, but you get 20, 30 times. Their only ticket out of poverty is drugs. And for people who are addicted to substances, the only way they can make the money to feed their habit is to deal. I'm convinced that what we're doing now is they're right. It doesn't work. We've just beefed up the size of our prisons and giving them to prisons where they're not getting any help with their substance, where they're getting, in your sense, you're saying easier access to drugs, that doesn't help us in any way.
Back to the education, like I asked about, but my son that committed suicide is a victim of Ritalin, to start with. Instead of trying to challenge his abilities, they gave him Ritalin, pushed him aside, you know, and I offered to take him out of school and let him know that he could not go to school unless he did the right things. Now we have this challenge of private school systems. In those days, they said it was illegal. I couldn't take him out of school. So we're really legalizing drugs in an illegal way. I mean, in a legal way. It just seems like it's a catch-22 thing. And
just kind of on the education thing, I work as a chaplain in a trauma hospital in Ireland, and it's almost, I'm trying to think what percentage-wise, I would say at least 90% of the time when I'm called into the emergency room, there is somebody there under the influence of alcohol who's had an accident. Excuse me. And often it's somebody, a teenage kid. But one of the programs that they have developed in our area is a grant that somebody had written and was funded by. It's a program called Every 15 Minutes. Has anybody ever heard of it?
Yes.
And they have, what they do is they go into the high school junior, senior year, and they touch the juniors and the seniors, and they actually put on a presentation just like there's been a regular accident. And they come in with the fire department, the police department, they have the mortuary come, they do the whole thing. It's just like, and they'll have four kids in the accident, you know, they never know how many exactly are actually gonna die as a result of this accident. But they, it's emotional because it's a very emotional experience for me when I do it. And then they bring the kids into the hospital and they do just exactly like you would in the emergency room with all of the things. The parents notify the parents that the child is dead. The law enforcement chaplains go to the home or the office where the other kids' parents are. And they do the whole thing and they're videotaping everything throughout the day. And every 15 minutes they have what they call the Grim Reaper. And he goes into one of the classrooms. And he just points at a kid or touches him or lays a black rose down on the desk. And that kid gets up and leaves. And they leave for the day. And they do that every 15 minutes, which represents the fact that every 15 minutes a teenager in this country is killed as a result of drug. But they tape everything. And then they have the parents and the kids each write out of the kids that are picked up and, you know, the living dead is what they call them. They have the parents write letters to the kids, and they have the parents write an obituary for the kid, and they have the kid write an obituary for themselves. And then they put up tombstones out on the campus that represent each one of these kids. So it ends up at the end, and like I said, they filmed it. They take the kid to the morgue, they take the kid to the jail, book him, put him in the jail, in the cell, the whole ball of wax, just like it was real. And they film the whole thing, and then the next day the kids go back, and all of the people involved, the chaplain, the law enforcement chaplain, the hospital chaplain, even the dispatcher for the police department, everybody come, and they show the tape. And a couple of people talk who've lost kids in accidents, and then they show this tape, and then they ask all of the people involved to please stand up. And you've got several hundred kids. And I sat there with this thing, with the highway patrolmen, are, you know, just sobbing at what's going on. But it is very impactful because it ends up at the end of the assembly, how many knew one of the kids? Well, everybody in the assembly knew somebody as a result of that. And it's very, very impactful and very powerful in really letting kids know what happens when an accident happens. And how many people it involves that they don't even know beyond their family.
And tying it back to Paul's point about what we're doing now not working, I think you'd have to say we spend a lot of money on this, again, that Center for Abuse and Substance, Addiction and Substance Abuse, saying that we're shoveling up the costs. Again, a lot of those shovel up costs are those prison terms. I mean, in typical state, $30,000 to $40,000 a year for one inmate for 1 year. And I would say in many states they're not having easier access to drugs in the prison, but they're not getting any help with their problems either. And taking a fraction of that money and putting it into education things, and there are thousands of working things that do work in education, and there are many types of treatment. Treatment's not 100% effective, which is one of the criticisms of it. Oh, I know so-and-so, they went through treatment, they still serious problems. Well, William Pope Boyer said he went through it 3 times before he got the help he needed. Many times people have inadequate. A lot of judges refer people to treatment. They send them to AA, which is important, but it's not treatment. And they say, oh, this person's failed treatment 3 times. The point is, you know, cancer treatment's not 100% effective either. It doesn't mean we say, the heck with it, it doesn't work. No, we say it works, it definitely works. It's not 100% effective, and putting these resources into that is far more effective than that, which is why I'd argue the decriminalization, because I do have a philosophical problem with, not philosophical, practical problem with the fact that decriminalizing something seems to say government, legalizing it says, then you, first of all, we get all the advertising then too. Why do we have so much beer and wine and cigarette consumption? Despite the health risks, which are well publicized, it's because day in and day out they see the pictures in the movies and billboards and television commercials for alcohol.
So often when they go into a treatment, they have the right to walk out before they've been there very long. I lost a grandson last month. Yeah. He was 26 years old. Oh. And he had been in and out of drugs probably for 10 years. And he would go into a treatment, he'd be there maybe 5 days and walk out. Mm-hmm. And finally, he lost a friend in the hotel that he was staying in. Mm-hmm. And it really got to him, and he said, I'm going to stick it out this time. And he went into treatment again. He was there 4 weeks. He went to bed one night and died in his sleep.
Oh.
And the coroner says there were no drugs or alcohol in his body, but they haven't gotten a full report yet, so they don't know if his death was caused from damage from long-term drug use or a heart attack or what. But he continued to go in and out, and he kept giving him public assistance, mm-hmm. and I think if they've been a requirement in order to get that,
you have to stay in the treatment. Yeah,
because they don't do that.
Yeah, and with alcohol, with legal drugs, you can't really force somebody to stay in treatment. You could, to a certain extent, with illicit drugs, but it's a very tough one. And people, you can, again, treatment is always, in a sense, forced, either by family members or by the courts or somebody. And yet, it does work. I mean, they used to say, do you have to want to go into it to get it? No, but that may help, but there are lots of people who succeed the other way. Well, close with Jeannie's comment.
I was just going to say, I think we all learn so experientially in this idea, they do something like that in some of our high schools is so important because you learn by experience. But the other thing I was going to say is I'm also a hospital chaplain, and we have an addictions unit in our hospital, and they go through the 12-step program. The fifth step, I hear a lot of fifth steps, and that's when you say before another human being, yourself and God, the wrongs that you've committed. And every, probably 99% of the fifth steps that I listen to, sometime in their story, they talk about having no self-esteem. And that's one of the reasons they choose to use these drugs and alcohol, is because of low self-esteem. And I really truly believe that addiction, besides being a hereditary thing, and we know all that, is also a spiritual issue. Mm-hmm. Because so many times those people don't have a spiritual connection to God. They don't realize they're a child of God. They have this void in their lives they talk about, and they are trying to fill it. And what, you know, I think the self-esteem we give our kids, the way we connect them or our grandchildren to families and to God and to knowing their love is a huge factor in getting well and not getting in it at all. So I truly believe it's also a spiritual issue.
And with that, it suggests that a whole lot of these mental health and chemical dependency and spiritual health things all do tie together. And anyhow, I hope this has been helpful.
I just have one comment. In Yakima, we have a program called At Risk, where these children are not in trouble, but from their environment, they might be. And they take them from first grade on through sixth grade. And the fellow Greg that's in charge of it, he is so loving to those kids. They just swarm around him. And the community supports them with camps and YMCA.
It's a great program.
It helps with that self-esteem.
That is, yeah.
Well, I hope this, I better cut it off. I'll stay around and talk individually, but thank you very much. I hope.